Alright, the recorder is on.
Alright, welcome to the regular meeting and public hearing of the North Bend Planning Commission for Thursday, October 25th, 2018. Get away from the heater. Called this meeting to order, now do a roll call. This is Commissioner Heller speaking.
Commissioner Ryan.
Commissioner Tao.
Commissioner McFarland.
Commissioner Bellers.
And we have, who else in the room? Mike McCarty, staff.
Christina Wollin with Marti.
Okay, sounds good. Now, next up is to approve the agenda.
So moved.
Alright, second?
Second motion.
Okay. Any comments or changes to the agenda?
Good.
I need to accept myself from not being there.
Well, we'll get to the minutes, The agenda, everything look good? Okay, all those in favor approving tonight's agenda, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? None, so agenda is approved, it's unanimous. And now we will move on to the minutes. I'll make a motion to approve the minutes.
Second.
Alright, second by Mr. McFarland. Comments or changes? Mr. Bellers.
Yeah, I'll need to accept myself from not being there.
Okay, you will, you'll abstain.
Yeah.
Alright. Any other questions?
You made the motion?
I did, yep. Any comments, changes?
None.
Alright. All those in favor of approving the October 11th Planning Commission meeting minutes, say aye.
Aye.
And none opposed, so those are approved. And we have the public comment on non-agenda items. Seeing we have no public in attendance, we'll close that. And we'll go to the public hearing. It is 7:04, we're a minute early on that.
Rockin'!
I guess we'll open up the public hearing for the amendments to the floodplain management regulations, North Bend Municipal Code 14.12. To address requirements of the biological opinion on FEMA's national flood insurance program. That's what we'll talk about tonight. And seeing that there's no public in attendance, do we just close it up, Mike?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll close the public hearing. No public are in attendance. We'll move on to the Planning Commission deliberation and recommendations on said floodplain management regulations.
All right. Well, Christina's introduced herself already, but she is our floodplain consultant for the city. Works for the seat, and she's a certified floodplain manager, which means that she knows a whole lot more about this National Flood Insurance Program and the biological opinion on the listing of Chinook salmon and orcas than I do. Christina's prepared these amendments, and she's here to address the questions that you guys might have. So we introduced this at your last meeting. It's basically just a minor update to reference requirements on those habitat assessments that are required to be prepared in association with federalization.
I'd like to ask a question for the order, and that is, even though we're looking at the amendments that are being proposed, does the entire ordinance become open for public debate and consideration?
We could do additional amendments at this time as well. We should keep it in fairly minor scope unless we were to re-notice a public hearing to the public for more substantial changes.
But I'm right. Unless we open up for the amendments, the whole document becomes available for review.
Dick, do you mean beyond Chapter 14? Or I want to just be sure I understand what you're asking.
I'm asking if the whole document, the whole chapter is open
the
for.
The entire chapter.
Not that I don't. That's just a point of order of my information.
Yeah, it is open. If there were things that were not noticed for the sake of the public hearing, we should hold another hearing just so the public has the opportunity to comment on whatever changes are made if they're more than minor in nature.
Right. Got it.
Okay. Cool.
Do you want to continue introduction?
Sure. So we mentioned this at the last meeting, but we've got the two maps that are going to be referenced in the regulations, which are just for the sake of establishing that buffer from the protected zone. And then the riparian habitat area, or the riparian habitat zone, is a part of what establishes that protected area which the buffer is established on. Other than that, the regulation amendments are more about the habitat assessment and the process by which that's submitted and reviewed under. All the amendments are redline format there, and we can open it up to discussion and questions.
So, okay.
I'm sorry, Christina, did you want to provide more to...
Did you provide an overview of... Do you understand the background of where these requirements are coming from and how North Bend has been enforcing them for years already?
I'd say real fast refresher wouldn't hurt.
Okay. Okay. So these are as a result of what's called the National Flood Insurance Program BIOP. And this affects any floodplain that drains into Puget Sound. And the overall intent of it is to prevent takes of endangered species, which would basically be a dead Chinook or a dead orca. And but to get to that point, there have been lawsuits and more lawsuits and processes with FEMA and with the National Marine Fisheries Services, where they have developed regulations that need to be enforced, processes that need to be enforced by these communities with the Puget Sound, within Puget Sound. And these have been in effect since 2011. So the city has been enforcing these regulations, or has supposed to have been enforcing these regulations since September 2011. I think the city's done a very good job, especially in the last few years, along with all of Puget Sound, of starting to really do a good job of the process that everyone has to go through with habitat assessments. And so these updates are nothing new. It's just putting into code the process that's already implemented, which has a number of benefits for the city and for people developing.
I just asked.
Good to have information, be clear of what we're doing.
And so there is the protected area and the riparian habitat zone. And the riparian habitat zone, we're including it in the definitions because it is it's how you define where the protected area is. But there are no specific regulations that occur within the riparian habitat zone. It's just a line on the map, pretty much. The protected area has different types of enforcement required if you're within the protected area or outside the protected area. So this one does have some changes, the primary being that you can't do mitigation when you're in the protected area. So the mitigation, for example, if you are impacting a wetland for the critical areas ordinance, you do mitigation, and maybe you do 2-to-1, so you, I'm not sure what yours is, but if you impact 100 square feet of a wetland, you might be required to build 200 square feet of new wetland as mitigation. But that's not allowed within the protected area, so the project has to be designed to avoid any impacts, and so the project can't cause impacts in the protected area, which in North Bend is not really an issue because there are no endangered species in the rivers at North Bend. Amazing day to see an orca up here, or a Chinook salmon.
When that orca comes up over the falls, it's going to be quite the national news.
Yeah. But there are potential indirect impacts if the water quality was so poor or polluted that it affected the fish downstream, but that's not going to happen either on any permitted project in North Bend because of all the regulations.
What keeps us from dredging the rivers is the Shorelines Act.
I mean, yeah. There's shorelines, there's...
But if we could dredge the rivers, we would reduce our flooding potential.
Well...
But that's what I'm saying. That's the trade-off. So it does affect us. Even though there are no species up here, we have to react.
Yeah, it doesn't. The fish aren't here, and the direct impacts aren't here, but you still have to look at it.
So could I ask, based on what you were saying about the definitions? So the first definition around protected area, that one's being given to us by FEMA.
Mm-hmm.
And through all of this negotiation, it's basically saying you need this definition. And that's why we're adding it.
Yeah, it's because we're calling out in one section of this code update, we're saying protected area. And so we need to define what that is.
But is this their other jurisdiction definition, or
it's
this is
FEMA.
One we wrote?
It's the BIOP definition.
It's the BIOP, that's what I was, I'm sorry.
Yeah, as well as the riparian habitat zone, that's the BIOP definition as well.
So the last sentence of that one is, if no CMZ is identified in the riverine system, protected area extends to the outer limits of the floodplain.
You're on page one.
I'm on page one, very
chapter.
First page, very
14.
So, is this not being reflected in Exhibit B in a much wider area because we have identified the CMZ throughout the city limits?
That's correct.
Okay.
But there's only CMZ identified north of the railroad. There's only a defined CMZ in this area.
That's kind of where I'm about to head.
But the studies, the CMZ studies have stated that there is little chance of channel migration past Tanner, so down here. There's little chance of channel migration on the Middle Fork, and then below the railroad, there's levees right here, so there's no migration right there, and then below the levees or upstream. There's little chance of channel migration. So they did not identify. They did a study, but they found there is no channel migration, which is different than what this says. This would be if you haven't done a study.
I want to be very careful about this, because to me, that sentence has major implications for our city. So, and because, if I'm interpreting it correctly, anywhere we can't show that we have done the CMZ identification, the boundary is the whole of the floodplain.
That may be a good point to add directly in the definition. Within North Bend, based on the 2000, whatever it was, King County Channel Migration Study, there is no channel migration in these areas. That way it's very clear.
Well, I like the way you're going. Let me push it a little bit further, because that, I think, you're addressing the current city limits. And so my next question was going to be, and what about when we annex a new area that may be, say, on the South Fork, since that's one of the directions the city is heading. It's about the only direction the city is currently heading in. Urban growth area, right? So if there are areas currently outside the city limits but where the floodplain applies and they haven't been mapped, then that boundary suddenly explodes to be the whole of the floodplain. Am I getting that right?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, may I just ask one more definition on that? Are we talking about the expansion areas within?
Well, I'm trying to think of it broadly, Dick. I'm trying
I am
to think
too.
Of it within the UGA, with just the city limit to existing UGA.
Yes.
And then 20 years down the road, or whatever down the road, if the UGA were to expand, and that means it's
I applaud your thinking that way.
Right? That just, do we cripple ourselves if we're not careful about how we define that.
And that's, well, that's just what I'm trying to get to with you.
Yeah.
Or do we have the ability to look that, to officially look that far ahead, or does?
Well, I don't think we can in regard to what that line might be, but I think we can in regard to being careful about the definition.
So I think the answer might be in that the study was prepared by King County, not just within city limits, but for the reach of the river, of the Middle Fork and the South Fork. So
they don't define an end point where they stopped looking. Uh-huh. But we can look at, and I don't think you can change the definition. You could add to it based on the, I think it's like 1996, it's a pretty old study that it's not that there's no channel migration, it's that there's very little risk of channel migration. So an area was not defined. I understand how exactly though what your point is.
There must be a way to codify that, because I agree with you, Rob, that here we have a chance to do something long range. And
maybe it's even as simple as how I'm interpreting Exhibit B.
I'm wondering, like in a specific area, like over on Tanner, like you were saying, was there a CMZ defined there, or are they just extending to the edge of the floodplain?
At Tanner, the CMZ, it shows that it stops here at city limits because I don't show what's in the county, but it continues down the county or down upstream a little bit. But they define that after Tanner, there's not risk of channel migration.
Right. And maybe it's the way trying to get to what you guys are both kind of saying about this King County study. If there was something, if there was a red outline on the map that said everything in this was part of that King County study, and to Mike, what you're saying, some sort of a parenthetical at the end or a footnote that says, hey, everything per the study is addressed, or, however that would be best stated. I mean, maybe that would be the blanket that says what we're what we're looking at is what it is. It doesn't change when that some line moves.
Maybe we could add in that the channel migration zone has been defined by the King County study.
Yeah, that's a good
which has identified no risk of channel migration upstream of Tanner and upstream of the Burlington Northern.
There you go.
That gets
much better.
Because there was there's a section that they identified. They put red lines around it to show the levees, and then identified no risk upstream of that point. So
if there was a subsequent study that did identify risks, what's that implication?
We would have to change the protected area.
Which would have to come back to us.
So that maybe the protected area definition itself stays the same, but the reference to the map can reflect that language, which we put into on the top of page 6 in the regulations, starting at the bottom of page 5. Cities prepared maps identifying the approximate boundaries of the protected area after creating habitat zone needs to establish the protected area available on the city's website. And then we can have that statement.
Yeah.
Something that just kind of helps me that I don't have a fear that just because I'm not in the green zone, but I would hate an applicant to come in feeling that they've reviewed this and they're feeling okay. And then you go, well, gee, but actually, no study was done there. So the first thing you're going to have to do is do a study to prove that you're not.
Whatever. So the protected area, the only types of projects that it's going to really affect are projects that have a negative impact on the river. And so it's going to be really hard to permit those anyway with all the other land use regulations associated with them. Because any other project, subdivision, even just a basic commercial, retail, mm-hmm. anything, multifamily, they'll be able to design the project to avoid any impacts and be able to work. And
I agree with you, provided they're outside of the protected area.
No, inside the protected area as well. Yeah. Especially the benefit that North Bend has is there is no direct impact. You're not going to end up with a dead fish on your shoreline because there are no endangered species in North Bend.
Right.
And so the impact to the rivers is mostly water quality, water temperature, mm-hmm. things like that. And so you're not limited, like, you know, downstream to the communities that are right, have fish, you know.
Well, I guess what's concerning me with that, based on what we've been hearing about the new court case and regulation related to salmon and orca and such in Puget Sound, saying it isn't only about what's going on in the sound, it is all the way upstream. And so for the implication of if someone were to make the case that somehow something we're doing or something that a developer were permitted to do, or just an individual, you know, it could be a farmer, will raise the temperature in this stream, and that impacted all the way down the line. You know, that's how I say, I agree that we don't have the protected species here, but what we're being told is, but the things we do here do indeed potentially impact mm-hmm. down the line.
Yeah.
That's what I'm
concerned. But you're not going to be able to do a project, even taking out this habitat assessment, mm-hmm. you're not going to be able to do a project that has that great of an impact on the river. It's just not going to be permitted through the stormwater regulations and critical areas regulations.
Okay.
And shoreline regulations. There's so much already on top of this mm-hmm. that this is kind of, in North Bend, it's more of an afterthought and a procedural.
And that's also what we reflected in our habitat assessment worksheet. So this is kind of a template for simpler projects to follow in creating a habitat assessment. We reference those other regulations. Subject to conformance with stormwater regulations and critical area regulations, you're not creating an impact.
Okay.
So we keep hearing, I keep just barging in because it was decorum. But we keep hearing that whatever we do here, we'll be treated as though it will impact somebody. Because if we don't, if the codifiers can't expect people to follow the code, that's, we're winking at it because it's not really going to affect anything. All of a sudden, we lose control of what we've established here. So
yeah.
Don't tell me that we're not going to force these codes because it's not really going to hurt anything. I think we know better than that. We hope we know better than that, that they're not just going to ignore what we do up here. I think we can do a lot of impacts there before you know it, and you're going to lose control. But not that Rob's going to do anything that's going to impact anything bigger than I am. But I'm glad to hear that we can look beyond the city limits in terms of defining this map, because people look at the map and say, well, there's nothing, no problem out here outside the dotted line. And in fact, that's not true at all. And we've not said that in the preamble anywhere, that outside the state limits has not been studied, therefore it can't be part of the
I think you're basically saying the reverse, right? Is that King counties didn't really pay attention. They're not looking at the city limit, they're just looking at this area. Right? So that worked for me. And to be clear, I'm the least worried about large developments because of all of the other regulations that we have. I'm most concerned with the little guy who is trying to do some simple project and get so many regulations and you can't even turn around before you've got to hire professionals at considerable expense.
Yeah, so the little guy, they've already got to follow the stormwater, the critical areas, the shoreline. When you get to this one, the type of project that this habitat assessment process may make more difficult is if they have pristine natural habitat on the shoreline and they want to cut it all down and put a whole bunch of pervious surface, pave their yard, and which is already like, so, but shoreline, the shoreline's already going to, if they're in the shoreline,
right.
It's already going to have a effect on that natural habitat. There's not a lot of natural habitat shoreline left within city limits.
Yeah.
So that's more of a county issue that they'd have to deal with out in the county. The stormwater covers the impervious surfaces. So, you know, everything's already like double or triple covered on almost all of these requirements.
It's interesting to hear them all interconnected, all these different regulations, but one of them we just went through is critical areas ordinance, and the stream buffers was one. Maybe different opinions as if it goes to the city council as far as what that ultimately is. And so let's say in the critical areas it was pretty low, maybe a small buffer on fish streams or something like that. Like what's in the protected area have any benefit or kind of add to it or, kind of go, or is it, it's the lower level as you described.
The protected area, the only difference, and this this is what I was told in a training by a guy from FEMA. So it's semantics, basically, the no mitigation. So you can say that your, there was a project out by Tanner, and they're putting that stormwater line in that's going to overflow into the river.
Right.
And so they have to do some digging on the way to the river, and they're within all those shoreline buffers and everything. And so they called out mitigation. So they're going to do plantings and clean it up, get rid of the garbage, just make it look more natural, which they called mitigation. However, that's just in the eyes of a habitat assessment, you can just take that and say it's part of the project. So in addition to
it's enhancement,
they're enhancing, they're restoring, they're enhancing. It's not mitigation because that project has no, it's not going to cause a take, it's not going to cause a any harm to those endangered species, but it is going to enhance the area. So maybe in the critical areas report, they talk about mitigation that they're doing. In the habitat assessment, they just talk about the restoration. It's semantics. It's the same thing, but call it one thing or call it the other. And that's why any project that's in the protected area is going to be able to occur unless they have some major negative impact to the river.
The protected area has got a lot more stringent provisions if you're not in an urban area like we are. So there's pretty stringent clearing limitations. I don't remember what some of the others were, but a lot of those things we really could not apply within a developed context in an urban area like this. So I guess the overall definition of the protected area isn't as relevant to us, but we still have to identify.
Yeah, the projects out at the parks, putting in the new trails and the bridges, they're taking out blackberries. And that's not native vegetation. And so they're in the protected area, they're clearing, but
hard to call that a bad thing.
Yeah. And so, and that's even in the parks that are preserved. So even in the parks, we're not seeing the native vegetation. So it's just an extra box to check. The city has to look at it a little differently.
Well, I think, I mean, where I was going with the first question that sparked this conversation, I think, is being addressed by the proposal to add the qualifier. So I think that'll get what I was concerned about. Did you say that the riparian habitat zone definition is different as far as it didn't come out of this?
No, that's directly from the BIOP also.
It is also.
Yeah. I think we changed the language a little bit to make I can't remember what the original was, but we changed it to ordinary high water mark. It was like from the edge of the stream or something. It didn't make a lot
more defined.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And fairly consistent in other areas.
Yeah, so if you look at the biop and you read this, the wording will be different, but it means the exact same thing.
Okay. In C, at the end, I don't know if my brain just isn't working around this, but it says, blah, blah, blah,
lakes.
Type F streams less than 5 feet wide for lakes. Am I not?
Oh.
I'm tripping on
for
lakes.
Or lakes. Yeah, I think there's mismatch.
Meant to be
or.
Okay, that's okay.
Yeah, we'll double check and make sure, but there's no lakes in North Bend, so it's kind of irrelevant.
Irrelevant, yeah.
Anyway, but this is part of the definition.
And then, and this is maybe, and again, if it's coming right out of the biop, I don't know what we do about it, but these, the footages related to the different types, I wish they were consistent with our other buffers that we just spent so much time, right? It's like, yeah, go down here and look at this code. Here's your buffer record. Oh, sorry. No, this one's the buffer. Oh, well, no, that's not it. Here's another one. Particularly, and I think this goes to part of the conversation that we had looking at our other buffer requirements, the D for type in, you know, a seasonal stream.
Yeah, bro.
I'm still on page one. Riparian habitat zone. It's the second definition, and part D is referencing the type N perennial and seasonal, and the buffer up to 225 feet.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Really out of keeping with, I mean, our, you know, our old buffer code was 25 feet.
This isn't a buffer, mind you, though. This is just the definition of the zone where vegetation is more influenced by water.
I understand. Not a buffer, but it brings implications, right, on what?
Well, it defines where the protected area is. That's it.
And as soon as you say to me, though, protected area, what I hear is, okay, I'm going to be restricted. There's a hammer out there. I may not be able to do what I would otherwise be able to do under this code section that says my distance is 50 feet.
Well, but the protected area doesn't have any bearing on the buffer, on the critical area's buffers.
Yeah.
So you may be in the protected area, but you may be outside the critical area buffer, and so it's not going to affect the critical area's regulation. It's just going to affect you from calling your restoration project mitigation, if it's even required at all. Most of the protected area that is in the developable areas of the city is already disturbed. It's already, there's no way you can make it worse, basically. And so the protected area, it's based on current condition of the land, not what it looked like 200 years ago. So if it looks really bad today because it was an old yard or something, and you're going to put a project on it, you're only going to make it better, most likely. So.
This woman walk away.
Yes.
Next week, King County is coming out to give us their point of view on the Middle Fork. We got a presentation in the library on Tuesday after Wednesday next week. The information that they're going to share with us, is that going to have any impact on the information in this report?
I don't know. I'm not familiar with what they're going to be talking about.
They're talking about long-term flood predictions, things of this nature.
Yeah, similar to what they've done with the South Fork, having an overall flood study that identifies what's the best measures to address it. Is
oh,
it dredging?
It,
is it
yeah.
widening the levees?
It probably won't, unless it defines channel migration zones, which they're not likely to look at in a flood study. That would be it. But then again, as there's not...
Would we be advised to hold off on a decision tonight until that comes out?
No. So you said it was going to be the Middle Fork?
Yes, exclusively Middle Fork.
Yeah, so...
Middle Fork is not in our jurisdiction anyway. So our city limit line is...
Yeah, so the thing about the Middle Fork is that the floodplain, the protected or the protected area can't extend beyond the limits of the floodplain. So what you see, these little orange slices down here, that's the extent of the floodplain. So it can't get any larger down in that area.
That happens to be my property. The little slice.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's no comfort to me.
But it, yeah.
And
some of it's on top of the blue as well. So some of it's in the riverbed.
Okay, so their study's not going to...
Their study can't make it
any... It's not
going to
impact this, what this ordinance is tonight, but it might inform us about what potential impacts we will get in the city at some point. Don't you think, Mark?
Right. Probably, yeah.
I was just still looking on this first page. It's interesting with the, you said riparian habitat zone doesn't necessarily have any regulation behind it, I think one way to describe it. But in the protected area definition, it does say it's defined as greater of the floodway riparian habitat zone, or if there's a CMZ study. So in that way, then it goes down the riparian habitat zone, and then it gets into some of those distances.
Yeah, and that definition of protected area is the only reason that we're putting this definition of riparian habitat zone.
Yeah, because you need to have that.
Yeah, although FEMA wants to see it defined in the ordinance as well. So it kind of is for two reasons, which it's just there.
So if something's not in the floodway, there hasn't been a CMZ study, then it would be whatever the distance away from Morgan High Watermark is that would define the protected area.
Yeah.
Mike, on page two of the opening statements.
Of the regulations or of the staff report?
Not the red lines. Right after the first page. On the second page, it looks like there might be a typo on the paragraph number, chapter number, down towards the end where it says 1212.
You're looking at the memo.
Yeah,
oh, okay. Yeah, just the numbering there?
Yeah. That was definitely incorrect. I think it was actually meant to be 1412210.
Yeah.
After I found it.
Yeah. Okay. And also on the very top of that page where we have a qualified professional, is that defined somewhere qualified?
It is. Yeah, it's defined in our critical area regulations. And the flood regulations reference to the critical area definitions.
So, Christine, do you know the date of the last firm?
April 19th, 2005. I see that every day.
You know, I'm a scrutinizer, and I read this whole thing, and I can't come up with anything that I have any problem with, except that paragraph number.
Dick, you and I are just not on the same page.
I know we're not. I know we're not, Robert.
I've got a few other questions. Good. But I will sit back. I'm ready for page three.
All right. We're making it.
You skip it right
we skipped two
page
pages.
Two.
All right. Go for it.
So... So page three, now it's item D under 1412030, the development permit, and it's discussing the waiver, and I read this list, and I was curious how we originally came up with that list, if it was handed to us, the electrical repairs, furnace repairs, et cetera, and I'm reading through those and scratching my head going, What in the world could replacing the furnace inside a home have to do with the subject matter?
It's pretty ridiculous.
And thus, where my head went, which actually is spoken to somewhat later in the document at 1712.170, where we get back to discussing 50% valuation. And so my question is, why are we making this list? Why don't we simply exempt anything that doesn't meet the 50% valuation number consistent with other code and or a change in footprint? Because it seems to me that what we're trying to be careful about is the footprint, impervious surface within the area, right?
It's also that valuation. So correct me if I'm wrong, but we're required to track valuation over a period of 5 years of any improvements to that structure within the floodplain. And if they then hit that 50% value, then substantial improvements are triggered. So these kind of things.
So the five-year number comes in from also from FEMA.
No, the five-year number is the cumulative improvement is a city regulation that goes beyond the FEMA requirements.
Which helps us with our CRS credit, community rating system.
Well, if it's about the CRS, then to me that does point back to FEMA. It's not simply our local determination of what constitutes.
It's back to FEMA, but it's optional. It's going to that next higher level so you can get that discount on insurance right. for your residents.
Right. Okay. So that is part of. Okay. So 5 years is important. Okay. Thank you.
So I'm familiar with a landowner that has a revetment wall in this area that was built before the code was even drafted back in the 50s. And they're making improvements on their house right and left, thinking about potential sale. Are they supposed to get a... They're technically out of the floodplain because of the wall, but if the wall goes away, they're totally in the floodplain. The house is right on the river. So do they have to keep notifying the city about improvements being made?
If they're anything that require a permit, then they're supposed to come in for that permit, and we're supposed to track the cumulative value of those.
Okay, these are cosmetic improvements at this point, it's not like...
Yeah, there's some cosmetic improvements that require building permits. So that's if they're out of the floodplain, then this is an issue. And if the current maps show that they're not in the floodplain, removing that wall is not going to make a difference until they redo the maps. But there's certain.
Well, the wall technically takes them out of the floodplain. It's high enough where it's not.
Well, is it really? But is it? I wouldn't think that the wall actually changes to where the floodplain map would be. It's simply
just
keeping home flooding.
Yeah, the maps right now, think of all the levees in town. The maps right now are made, if you imagine the levees are gone. And so the flooding is based on no levees.
Which has been.
And so it would be the same thing with revetments and things like that. When they did that study, they kind of erased them off the landscape.
Because it'd just be based on elevation.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So they can't put artificial barriers in as
unless they're certified by FEMA.
Yeah,
so our levees are not.
Yeah, certain types of levees can be shown as flood protection, but most of them you just have to imagine they're not there. When you look at the floodplain, it's as if they were not there. So if they're not in the floodplain right now, it may appear to be because of that wall, but it may also be just because they're high enough.
And I was just going to comment, you'd be amazed at what requires a permit. I just called in for a inspection on replacing a furnace today and scratched my head about that.
Yeah, and that's why we came up with this list of types of projects that may require a building permit, but they're generally over-the-counter permits. And so this takes away the requirement to do a flood permit, because
right.
technically any sort of repair or change to your structure requires a flood permit.
So, well, kind of going back to my first question, and we answered a piece of it, was that I was going to have about the five-year, but... you saying that a more that we have to have this list per what we're being told, or could we simply have in here what I've suggested, the more simple, the 50% five-year tracking and footprint?
We have this in here as a way to, because this is not called an exemption because you can't have exemptions to the foot permit. So this is in here. It's like an exemption.
We're waiving the
fee. It's the fee is being waived.
I was going to say, it's only related to the fee. You still have to come in the foot permit.
Well, that's why we have that simpler page, which I don't even know.
Yeah, one page here.
How often it's used.
But yeah, it does have.
We use it really often.
Like all those, all this protected area right in the city there, which is a lot, and a lot of those, a lot of people live right
well,
in there.
Well, the pink area, you want to look at the whole pink area as the whole floodplain. This is
okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I
exactly.
And why my brain sense. Didn't work earlier, but I caught from both of you why I was thrown by different sections giving different levels. This is about the fee, not whether or not.
Yeah, all the, yeah, so it's just a, it's a fee exemption, but it turns the flood permit into an over-the-counter pre-permit that you can just quickly fill out with your over-the-counter building permit, and it will get tracked because the cumulative, the idea of the cumulative is so that you can't piecemeal your house back together.
And believe me, we went rounds with the Department of Ecology and FEMA on this during our last community assistance visit, saying this is ridiculous to require a permit for a hot water heater floodplain. But it was the requirement. So that this was
so
kind
that's
of our
where
way
that one
city.
Came from. Huh?
Yeah,
I love those guys. Including the last one, number 10, at 750, because my comment there was, you know, you can't sneeze for that kind of money. My head, we shouldn't try never to cite a dollar figure versus a percentage, right? Because the dollar figure changes next year when the inflation changes, right? And so if we cite dollars, it should be qualified with a COLA. Follow me?
Yeah.
Because it gets out of, I mean, it just gets out of the dates immediately.
Yeah, I can't remember how we came up with 750.
But again, this is just a way to cost of the permit. I'm still going to have to do the permit.
Right, I understand.
The problem that would come with doing a percentage, if you do like 5% of the value of the structure, then you have to provide us the value of the structure, and you have to provide us the proper
versus just stating
estimate. Yeah, because an estimate can't be based on materials that your brother gave you from his housing remodel or your free labor. It's got to be based on market rates of all materials and all work. And so then it just makes it a little more difficult. But I know 750 is pretty low. But that was put in there just because I'm sure there's something we're missing. But just other.
We can't list every potential thing. But.
Right.
Yeah,
then if the dollar's in play, then I would just advocate that that dollar value be much higher. I mean, that just seems, that's, you can't buy a refrigerator for that, you can't buy a stove for that, maybe some dishwashers.
But those don't require building permits.
I understand, but this says a renovation or remodel that costs less than $750. I don't know what constitutes that.
I mean, is there any reason we couldn't bump it to 1,000? Or
try not to keep slamming the guy who's just trying to do a simple thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm totally with you.
Well, and I can't remember, was this language created by the city or was this?
This was created by the city in response to that requirement that a floodplain permit be required for any improvement. So this was kind of our way of thumbing our nose.
I guess I get some of the outside stuff. The inside stuff's really weird, though. Like if you had to replace your refrigerator, do you have to get a permit, too? Or?
No.
No.
Okay.
We don't No, there's a lot you can do for your house that doesn't need a permit that will increase the value, like new floors might, new floors and painting might, for resale anyway.
Some cabinets.
But
yeah, if you had a remodel project, yeah, like you did flooring in your house and it was 10 grand, then you'd have to get a floodplain permit.
No, because it doesn't require a permit.
Yeah, we're only talking about what requires a building permit in the first place here.
Okay.
Yeah. Although, technically, it would be any remodel of the house, but how is the city going to enforce someone replacing their flooring? It's hard enough to enforce people re-roofing and putting in new windows and things like that. Mm-hmm. So there is a concession that there are plenty of remodel type projects you can do in your home mm-hmm. that are just going to happen.
Plus those are more along the lines of maintenance. You're taking yeah. care of your house by re-roofing yeah. it.
Okay.
Whatnot, so.
Okay. The only way a homeowner's going to know they're in violation of a code is that when they go to buy windows to put in, the guy says, well, I can't put in until you get a permit. You know,
yeah,
all of a sudden that's how they find out, because you're not schooled in that. You're not going to even think about asking about
yeah,
that.
But this is good for the homeowner who comes in and asks that question.
Yeah.
And then they get to learn, they get a free flood permit.
So I'm just going to propose that number be 2,500. Start at 50,000. I thought I'd just kind of cut to the chase. I've got one thumbs up over there, Dick.
I have no problem with that.
Anybody object to giving these folks a break?
I'm not opposed to it. I'm trying to think about the number a little bit, you know, and like why it would matter if, you know, where 750 came from versus, yeah, like 20,000 or. I had
my heat pump replaced. I bought the house about 10 years ago, and I did get a permit for that, and I understand that heat pump contains all kinds of bad things inside there. They could be, if somehow they're exposed to the grounds, it could be a negative impact, so I get that. But I don't get these other items that are on here that don't have any environmental impact whatsoever.
Well, and I guess part of where I'm going with the idea of the dollar amount is that, you know, when I look at the list here, about the cheapest items on there, maybe if I'm replacing one window, you know, or something, but
it's
everything else in there is into the thousands easily.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
I locked my keys in my house. I had to break my window to get in. Oops, I didn't get a permit to break my window.
Now you get to get a flood permit for your window.
I mean, that literally happens, you know. I mean, it's so ridiculous to think about it.
Well, one question I have that'll help with Rob's point is, what is the cost of a floodplain development permit? Is there a standard fee, or does it vary?
No, it's based on hours. So it does add a lot of time and process, unfortunately, because it's not just a simple fee. If it's just a building permit by itself, we can do a $250 fee, but if it's anything that requires any kind of review, then we are required to set up an account with the applicant and bill our staff time, which is, you know, then it's a month or two out before the invoice is coming in.
You can't sneeze for that amount, mm-hmm. and by the time Mike touches it and the Public Works guy touches it, and maybe it goes out to Christina to review it or another consultant, The review alone is going to be $1,000 to $5,000 mm-hmm. for a permit, which should be at zero cost. Right? So that's definitely where I'm driving.
Yep. And Rob,
we're killing people.
It is an issue. It's a wallet issue. And when the good Lord built the Middle Fork, with landslides and this thing, a natural event will impact that river far more than replacing up 15,000 heat pumps.
Yeah, that's not the purpose, though. This substantial improvement, substantial damage requirement that mm-hmm. comes, that part comes from FEMA. The 5-year cumulative part, that's a city regulation. But the intention is that FEMA, if there is a flood and that house is damaged, FEMA is going to have to pay out for if they have flood insurance. And so once you reach a point where you keep adding to the value of your house, the payout from FEMA gets higher and higher and higher. So they want you to get to a point where you have to usually elevate the home or otherwise bring it into compliance so that when it does flood, it's not damaged. So it's all about the structure and FEMA's bottom line with their flood insurance. And it hasn't happened very often that there's been a substantial improvement in this city, especially as home values go up, then that 50% goes up too.
Sure.
And you can do a lot for 50% of the value of most of the homes in here. It's the smaller, older homes that haven't had a lot of maintenance that when people come in buy those and want to
rent. Or who tend to be occupied by our residents who have the lowest incomes.
Yeah, but they're also not going to be doing big remodels on them. So for them, it's not.
And therefore, don't need another fee. Just to be waived, you know, or to you know, get hit with a fee to prove that they're not doing something that doesn't qualify.
But we are waiving the fee for them, so we are.
If we raise that number.
Well, yeah.
Right. Going once.
What is it again that it takes to a building permit to? When is a building permit required?
There's a whole list of different activities that require a building permit. Anything structural, plumbing.
Larger than a certain size? Or?
It's not a size threshold.
Some of it's key to what it is, like Mike's saying, anything to do with plumbing and electrical, because those are things that can damage, right?
Yeah, it's like replacement of more than 2 feet of pipe.
In our jurisdiction, a re-roof does require a permit. Not all jurisdictions require that, but we do.
Usually windows, if you're changing the size of the window, if you're just replacing it like for like. Usually they have a list of what doesn't require a permit, because it's much shorter than the list of what does require a permit.
But kind of finished stuff, like replacing the carpet, replacing kitchen cabinets, things like that, that aren't structurally related to the home, don't require a permit.
So, we're talking about Exhibit B in terms of the map and the protected areas. The green properties are what's affected by this?
No, right now, so protected area is really only related to the mitigation issue that we talked about earlier. These are affected by, or the entire pink area on the map.
Pink area.
The pink area is a 100-year floodplain. So now you can just, these regulations don't have anything to do with whether or not you're in the protected area or in the riparian habitat zone. These are just across the board 100-year floodplain.
All right.
So I just wanted to go back to close the loop on the 2500.
Yeah.
Is that overall planning commission recommendation?
What's the 2500?
That's the only thing I'm trying to figure out is what is the best number? I'm open to increasing it. I guess one question I still have is, was that something that the city previously just offered up as an option, benefit?
I don't remember the history on that number specifically.
Or just even offering waiving the fee. Is that, do all cities have that?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
No, this is
so
actually
we don't have
pretty
to do
unique.
It. Okay.
Yeah, we talked about this because we waived the fee for storage sheds. So you have to get a permit to put a shed in your backyard if you're in the floodplain. But I don't remember how it came out, who wanted it. It may have been city council. I don't remember. But anyway, they wanted to waive the fee. So you don't have to pay for, you have to get a permit, flood permit, but you don't have to pay. So we thought, well, maybe this is a good way to address these other types of projects that are just over-the-counter permits.
Yeah,
and that's also why we created this form, to greatly simplify it. So this isn't your full floodplain application that talks about what's the elevation of the structure and all these other things. It's a much simplified statement, and then there's even this structure under 200 square feet placement certification. We're not reviewing it. It's just that
they're signing their name that we're going to follow these provisions when we locate our shed in the backyard. So it's simple for people to take and administer when it's one of these exempt projects.
Yeah, I think just thinking about a small project or what, you know, that's that kind of, it's a theme. Yeah. So 2,500, you know, with, can you do for 2,500 even?
It seems so small.
It's hard.
I want to say much higher number, but yeah. I would like.
I mean, if it was like 10,000 or something.
I don't even like the number, as a matter of fact. I don't even like the fee. The multiple fee thing is a problem for me. I'm even running for elections.
Can I just clarify the fee? Mm-hmm. Did you say the fee was, for the floodplain review and permit is based on staff time?
Is if it requires review. If it's just a matter of approve a building permit for, like, I don't know.
Right, but this is waiving the costs associated with the floodplain review.
Right. Yeah.
What do we bill the staff time out at?
It's at our billable rates, which are actually pretty high.
Like,
so mine is $200 an hour. $130
an hour. $130 an hour.
Yeah.
And he's worth every penny of it. I just wish he was actually getting it.
Yeah. Right. So for me, I don't know that there's a perfect number, best available science on a number like that.
Right.
But to me, the policy question is, at what threshold of review does the staff time become free? So
if I were able to starve out more of these kind of ideas by not allowing it to be billed, I'd do that.
Right, but I mean, we're not debating what kind of project, what the threshold is that triggers a building permit. We're not, that's not part of this discussion.
Correct.
So now it's just, what's the magnitude of the project that would justify waiving the staff time? And so 750, I think, is too low, but if that number got too high, conceivably the impact of that project could be higher.
Right. Yeah.
And now we're doing the staff review for free.
Giving money away.
So I think, you know, something higher than 750 is good. I think 2,500 is as good as anything else. But going much higher than that.
Can I get five out of
it? What's 3,750.
So if you're gonna do that, then I would also ask that you exempt these only to internal projects, because the idea is that these, like, this is a air conditioner repair or replacement. This is not a new.
We're only talking about the last one on the list, right?
Yeah.
But it is related, and I'm with you.
But if you get up to 5,000, you can install a heat pump for less than 5,000.
But I thought all we were considering was the renovation and remodel projects less than
5,000.
Are you saying that the above could be considered renovation and remodel?
Well, what I'm saying is that you raise that level up. So you want to install a new heat pump, and let's say it costs $4,000 because you got a good deal, and it doesn't qualify for exemption because it's not a repair or replacement, it's new, but it's less than $5,000, so then it qualifies for exemption. But that's going to require staff review. So that would be an example of something that would require staff review. If it's something that's outside the footprint of the existing house and existing mechanical units, it's going to require staff review.
That could apply to electrical repairs or air conditioners.
Well,
I mean, an air conditioner and heat pump is...
That would be a mechanical permit that's just pretty much an over-the-counter, which wouldn't require the staff review, but there are things.
But because it's in the floodplain, it raises a flag.
I generally support the direction you're going, Christina, that, and I think it kind of goes to where I'm just trying to strike a balance in, and that's really about the dollar, which is those types of things which truly do encumber staff time review that turn into a real review that starts to add up dollars internally, then, like it or not, okay, the applicant needs to pay for that. But the things that generally really shouldn't require, I mean, in all intent and purposes, you would not waste your time looking at this if somebody outside of our jurisdiction wasn't saying, hey, you have to look at this. I don't want to put that onto that poor schlub who's already paying the permit fee to do that, do the actual item, to pay on top of that this review fee simply because the dollar value was so low.
But the decision tree is like project, building permit, floodplain impact, dollar value, right? I mean, isn't that kind of the hierarchy that mm-hmm. it goes through? So, I mean, we're only talking about fees if there's a floodplain review that's required.
Well, here would be the example if we didn't have furnace as a excluded item, period, so to speak, right? I come in and as a good contractor, because it's really the contractor who comes in, right? He works in the city, doesn't want to get in trouble with the city, so he's going to put a new furnace in, and he comes to the city for his over-the-counter permit to install this furnace. Mm-hmm. And the city clerk looks at him and goes, well, you're in the floodplain. So that triggers this application. Oh, here, fill this one out, too.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, well, what do I have to pay to fill out that permit now and get that one approved? Well, I can't tell you because it's going to be billable time. And, oh, by the way, while I'm giving you this one over the counter, I can't actually approve the work yet because we have to wait. You know, it could be a couple weeks, could be a couple months until I've got staff time available to review this and decide whether or not it applies. And we'll let you know how much that's going to be.
So from the staff and implementer perspective, you hit the nail on the head. That is one of my biggest frustrations, is that when process begets process.
I know, but everything that you just described sounds like it applies regardless of the dollar value of the project itself.
Not if you can come in at a dollar and show a dollar value that doesn't trigger.
So we're assuming here that furnace isn't on there, right?
Yeah.
So the one that applies to them is the dollar amount one. So if that dollar amount's high enough to negate the smaller projects, then he's exempt from this and it stops that process, right?
It doesn't stop the process. It just means they don't have to pay the fee. They don't have to pay the staff time. That's what I'm struggling with.
Well, I get where you're going, Gary. And I guess I would say, so that's my tool to say then we ought to be looking at the whole process and why are we doing this.
So my perspective as a staff person that implements this a lot is 2,500 is probably about the right sweet spot. Because when you have to set up that account, there's a lot of staff time associated with just setting up the account and managing the account and creating invoices and things like that.
And that's wasted. And the applicant have to make a deposit to be drawn against. Mm-hmm.
It's another way to look at it, so it's not just for the customer.
No, it's landowner. Also for staff.
For what makes sense for you guys. It's not worth it.
Absolutely. Being able to move something out the door quickly.
All right.
These guys get their time wasted in many ways.
All right, so in a roundabout way, 2,500, 21.
Sold. All right. That was a 15.
Sound good.
Discussion, but we got a couple dollars out of it.
Have we thought about the idea of keeping an account for the homeowners, and as their account of expenses begin to add up, there's a threshold where they begin thinking about paying fees. In other words, backing into this thing, over the life of a homeownership, it might be 10, 15 years on average, people do things, improve things. What about the idea of just developing a building account where as they do things over time, at some point they hit a threshold where fees begin to kick in?
Well, I think that's way beyond our scope tonight, but I like the concept.
It's somewhat what you're trying to do here by just setting an artificial threshold of $3,500 or whatever that might be. Same idea, but you'd actually just keep track of your expenses, and at some point then you're at a fee limit.
I don't think we'll ever sell a fee limit.
I don't like the idea of all these fees. does, it, if it does any good, it does, it impresses upon the landowners that they're being watched out here. And don't mess up on terms of the shoreline issues.
Speaking of fees and costs, my next question is the bottom of that page under section E, the permit application itself in the process. My question is, can a layman meet these requirements? Can a non-professional actually do an application?
For a flood permit or for a habitat assessment?
No, I'm reading E, the application for a floodplain development permit. Any forms furnished by the director required by the applicants may include the following. Following parts. Now, critical area report, that's a professional, right?
That's when required for critical areas. Mm-hmm. The rest of it, yes, they can and they do.
Habitat assessment.
Provide
that. It must be an added, yeah. It was a negative vegetation.
And that's why I provided this habitat assessment checklist. Okay.
Except for the elevation certificate.
Right.
Yeah, so we're working under, in North Bend, again, most of the land that is affected by habitat assessment is already developed or disturbed in some way, so that's why we made this checklist, which can be filled out by someone who takes the time to sit down and read it and think about it, because it's just checking the boxes, because there's so much code already that addresses the issues in the habitat assessment or within the biop, that you're just checking the box that yes, I'm following stormwater requirements, yes, I'm doing this, yes, I'm doing that. And just it's procedural basically most of the times. Especially if it's some empty lot that's in the middle of the block that's flat and everyone's built up around it and it's a mile from the river.
Yeah.
It's procedural.
Well, they're not even in the impact area there. I mean, if you're a mile from the river, you're not in the impact area.
You can, well, maybe a mile's too far, but you're in the middle of a pink area here, downtown, and you want to fill in a vacant lot or tear down a house and build a new one on a totally disturbed lot. There's no critical areas nearby. There's no river or shoreline nearby. You're just in the floodplain. This, you'll need the surveyor to fill out the elevation certificate. And of course, you'll need the architect or engineer for the building plans, but the rest of it, the homeowner could do it.
Yeah, we get up that situation with decks, porch redos, mm-hmm. things like that all the time, where they just literally draw the plans themselves. As long as it doesn't require that elevation certificate, then mm-hmm. process it, mm-hmm. get it out the door as quick as possible. Mm-hmm.
Still another one with questions.
I have a procedural one, but it can wait till the end.
Okay. Guess where my practical note is written is page 6. That's kind of where I started picking it up. So the top page 6, which is actually the end of continuation at the bottom of page 5, 1412070, item D. And so the context of my question here is we use the word feasible, and we use the word practical, and somewhere else the word reasonable. Maybe I came up with that one. And I started wondering about definitions for each, because each of those words to me mean significant different things.
What are the sections that have those words?
Well, so bottom of page 5, item D, the 1412070D, and second line. So it starts, all new structures shall be located there when feasible. If the lot is fully in the floodplain, structures must be located, and I guess next page, have the least impact on riparian habitat and listed species. All structures must be set back at least 15 feet from the protected area as practical. Mm-hmm. And that's where I was grabbing those two words, and I was trying to my first question always leaps to, well, who's deciding what's feasible and what's practical and what's reasonable? Is that because we didn't say that's a director's call?
Floodplain administrator.
Okay.
Just as at the beginning of this, it says they're the ones to make the decision.
That's the decision. Yeah. Okay.
And practicable. Here's the key word.
That's
and so
one
that
of
yeah that
okay.
that setback from the protected area.
Okay.
As practicable.
It has a definition.
It doesn't have a definition, but it's okay. That FEMA. It's verbatim, basically from the bio.
So the sentence itself is verbatim from the bio.
Pretty close. The practical word.
Yeah.
Practicable.
Practicable. Yeah, that's a tough word.
I always want to change it back to practical, but then I change it back to practical. That's what they said in the document.
Well, and that was because where my head, to me, that was kind of wordsmithing it. I was wanting to strike it from the end and insert all structures to the degree practical must be set back at least 15 feet from a protected area. But that's what, as soon as I wrote that, that's when it led me to going, well, what does practical mean? How do I define that?
Sometimes not having a definition can be beneficial because you have a little latitude.
Hopefully.
And to me, this setback 15 feet from the protected area
mm-hmm.
is a little goofy to begin with when you look at what the protected area is in North Bend.
Yeah.
And the size of the lots that are
affected
by the protected area.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like this is assuming some kind of rural lot in this huge open field in a small floodplain,
mm-hmm.
which is the opposite of our situation.
Well, I guess in the first place I got stuck, which was back when I read the word feasible and my head went to what's reasonable. If I can draw it, I'll point you to it to the degree that you can see it. I was drawing a lot on a street and I said, well, everything in the lot is in the floodplain except that very far corner. So the way I read that sentence was, that's where I got to build the structure.
But that's not practical.
Yeah.
Well,
it's feasible.
Oh, no, it's feasible. It is feasible. There's enough footprint space in the back of that lot. And you can define that as a 5,000 square foot lot or a 3-5 acre lot. But I'm the furthest point from the street.
Yeah, but then we would look at, if you're going to have to build a road through your entire lot, is that going to be more of an impact than a house? So if it may be feasible, but it's
maybe
not the
feasible,
best solution.
But it's not reasonable. And that's where I went to, which was, well, what's reasonable?
Yeah, and like Mike said, this is really an issue on large lots, which
yeah.
you don't have a lot of. You don't have
I'm not going to fight for particular wording
yeah.
if somebody else isn't.
I just had a clarification. Mike talked about it a little bit last time, but I still wasn't clear that. So we have the special flood hazard area, which is referenced in D, where Rob was at. And then, you know, the beginning of this chapter, then it talks about protected area and riparian habitat. So we've been talking about those a lot tonight. But in the majority of the document, it goes and starts talking about special flood hazard areas. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, so the special flood hazard area is the one under your flood. And that's what this chapter is regulating. We just had to put protected area and riparian habitat zone in the code because of the BIOP, but there's no difference in how these regulations are enforced in the floodplain, in
okay.
the special flood hazard area.
Yes,
you
can just say
the real purpose for all these fees is to discourage folks from doing things to their property. I mean, is that what this is all about?
It's not to discourage people, it's to ensure that when people build on their property, they're building it in a manner that is safe and that will prevent damage.
But it does have the effect of limiting, because tired of being giving the these fees out. It just does limit them, whether you want it to or not. It limits them from participating in the dream of building their home.
Well,
it just seems so punitive, all these fees.
Well, think about if there's a large flood. We have the 100-year flood in North Bend, and water is flowing through the entire city. And we don't enforce these regulations, and people's houses are flooded, or we enforce the regulations and make them build a couple feet higher, which adds cost to the project, but it doesn't add a great cost to it. And then they don't have any damage because the water was under the first floor. So that's what the point of this is, because it doesn't happen in Washington here very much, but anytime there's a hurricane or a flood in Texas or Florida, there's hundreds and thousands of houses that have flood damage.
Focus on raising the house up. But all these fees and all these other house projects have nothing to do with elevation. This has to do with adding value to the property or making it easier to live there. We're taxing them with these fees. They have nothing to do.
It's not necessarily fees. It's the valuation threshold that FEMA's interested in, that when they reach that 50% valuation, that they do bring it elevated so that it's minimizing damage and loss.
Christina. I just want to circle back to what I had mentioned, and I guess if the definition on page 2 is what the special flood hazard area is in a way, it's fine, that's fine, but that doesn't say 100-year floodplain. And so
which
that's,
page are you looking at?
Those are very specific known terms from FEMA, so this is the flood insurance
right. Yeah, but here. Just on a practical level, like, it sounds like it's the 100-year floodplain. Page 2, applicability, A. Letter A there, it says special hazard areas are identified by, and it gets into citing documents and studies mm-hmm. and everything, but it doesn't say simply as the 100-year floodplain, because that would have cleared up my questions right away.
Yeah, to my knowledge, they're trying to move away from the term 100-year floodplain.
Yeah, it would be also the 1% chance.
But that's how it's labeled on the map right here.
Yeah, that's because it's common terminology.
I know, and it's kind of like not that great for the common person, but... Anyway, that's all I have to say. Just want to make that statement.
Okay.
It's not ideal.
That's a good statement.
It may be in the definition.
Or, commonly referred to as, I don't know. It's just hard for people to know. All right, Rob.
Thanks. So we're at bottom of page 6, 14.12.080C. I was reading the electrical, mechanical, plumbing, heating, et cetera. The goal, of course, is to make sure all those systems are above the BFE, the flood level. Is that zero or
no.
two?
So this two. It's in there because it impacts flood insurance rates. So when the elevation certificate is filled out, it has the elevation of the first floor and the elevation of the mechanical.
Right.
And if the mechanical is at 0 and the first floor is at 2, and they take that elevation certificate into their insurance company, they will get paid insurance as if the entire house is at 0, which could be thousands of dollars a year.
Right.
So just simply elevating these things, which does cause some issues when you want to put ductwork under the floor and things like that, but...
Exactly why I'm bringing it up. This is one of my hard
yeah,
things.
But that's it. If you can prove that your ductwork is watertight, then ductwork can go under the floor, and I don't know how to show that on the elevation certificate.
Are you guys following? So this was a very practical thing that we ran into in building the cottage project. Was we all got and understood very well the 2 foot above base flood elevation that the house needed to be built at, right? Nothing, right? The floor, 2 foot above. But we missed the piece initially about how do you usually build a house with a forced air furnace? Well, the duct goes underneath the joist. Ah, nope, can't do that either. And so it really changed the design, interior design of the house. And so we have chases running through through the homes because you can't put
keep it
the ductwork underneath and stay out of the 2 foot, or you actually have to raise the house
even higher.
Another foot, right, or something like that. Yeah, so it that's why I wanted to be sure I was
yeah,
right.
Yeah, ductwork
on
is really the only utility this really impacts.
Yeah.
Or makes more difficult. Because it's easy to put your air conditioner on a platform. But
oh, okay. So we were, because we talked about ductless heat pumps earlier,
right.
So you could do that but have it raised.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, so ductless, right. Well, in a ductless, therefore, you don't have the ducts in
you
there, which was another option.
But you still have the external.
You
yeah,
still have
if
the
you
external
go look
unit
at,
that goes
well,
up. What?
Yeah, I think you have
okay.
one in the backyards. But
yeah.
if you happen to be in a backyard of a newly constructed house in a floodplain, you'll notice the furnace, or, I mean, the air conditioner or the heat pump is at the same elevation as the floor.
Yeah, okay.
And in internally, typically, but if you see in the garage, you're going to see that the internal, the furnace,
water heater.
The water heater, everything's on a platform above.
Yeah.
Right, that's
okay.
My next question is definitely one that I think we need a change for. Bottom of page 7, 14-12-100, item E, references 50 lots or 5 acres.
That's a FEMA requirement.
That's their specific.
Yeah.
Do
so
they understand how far apart those things are? So for us, if we're LDR, 5 acres translates into now 17, 18 homes. Technically 20, but you can't get there under the rest of our regulations, right? 50 lots is going to take you somewhere between 15 and 20 acres. So to me, I'm just that those numbers are
yeah,
fast.
Those are the numbers straight from FEMA, from the codes and federal regulations.
Okay, I walk away.
Same page, E above that one in section 14-12-090. Above ground should be 2 words, right?
E. Oh, yeah. Space
yeah.
missing.
Just
yeah. You know, we're actually talking about items that are not up for review.
No, that was actually goes to my question that you were asking. This entire code section is for review, not just what's been edited.
That's what I've always believed, but it sounded like we're only be reviewing the red lines.
Yeah.
No, it's all up for grabs.
Okay.
I just want to make sure that if there's something more major, we're going to put it back out for the public to know about.
What I was thinking you were asking about, Dick, was that if we were considering something else in Chapter 14 outside of 14.12.
Yeah.
Right. So we have in front of us, well, actually, we've got in front of us all of Chapter 14.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'm going to display my total ignorance here, but I think it will help me a lot. I think I knew more about this than I do. You keyed me in pretty quickly in this whole when you said that FEMA won't insure these properties unless we do certain things. And the only way that we can build them is they will insure them. And I have FEMA insurance in my house. And I'm realizing that if I can't keep my house within the standards that they require for insurance, I'm dead in the water.
Well, that's almost correct. So it's... as you know, if you want to get a mortgage on a house that's in the floodplain, you're going to have to buy flood insurance.
Yeah.
So if the city doesn't enforce these regulations, when that homeowner goes to get flood insurance, the rates are going to be astronomical because the house isn't in compliance.
Yeah.
So it's really the city, you can look at it, one way of looking at it is the city is doing a service to the community. That's part of the reason the 2 feet above base flood elevation, the price difference from having a house at 0 to 1 foot above is thousands of dollars a year. and the difference when you go 2 feet, it gets down into maybe the hundreds of dollars per year instead of thousands per year. So the city's doing a service by enforcing these regulations.
So evidently, I did not understand that coming in. When I started reading this document, it probably would have helped me to have a primer on the purpose of FEMA and why FEMA has the authority to make these requirements of the city. And I don't get that. I'm reading this flat out from the stop-start. And I'm realizing I'm just seeing this wash of fees and almost a heavy-handed government process that is just killing me. It is really killing me. If I had something that's been in this document that explained to me what I was about to get into and why all these things are necessary, I'd be a more cooperative citizen by being informed about this, because this is totally different than building outside the floodway. I mean, I never heard of such a thing. And my house was built in 86 before all these regulations were prompted. And I thought it was strange that I was having to pay permits when I came and bought this house and added things to my house, but I accepted it. But I didn't realize where it was coming from. I didn't realize that FEMA was pulling. I thought the city was pulling these strings and just taking advantage of hapless homeowners out there. Yeah. That's my thinking. I don't think I'm the only one. I think
widespread thought.
Or just being taxed. But it's a privilege to live within the floodway for most of us, because we have different environments there than outside the floodway. But didn't realize that what I was actually paying to have that privilege. And it would help me to better understand all of this red tape if I understood how it evolved, why it's there. And if the intent is to keep people from living in the floodway, then damn it, get us out of it. If you can let us live there, then help us understand why we're paying for all these fees. They don't seem to be necessary. They don't seem to stop one drop of water from coming onto my property.
Well, it's not that it's going to stop water. It's that when it floods, your house isn't going to be damaged. And it's going to save you money. It's going to save your insurance company money. That's the overall intent.
Really? I mean, if I put a furnace in my house, how's that going to stop the flooding? Really?
It's not going to stop the flooding. It's going to... If we let you put an air conditioner outside your house and you just set it on the ground, and a couple inches of water comes up, it's going to ruin your air conditioner, and you're going to have to buy a new one. If we make you put it a couple feet up, then that water can just go under it.
I get that. And I know why my...
Yeah.
I know why my heat pump is now raised up. I mean, I get that.
Yeah.
I'm getting it. I appreciate that you're kind of coming around and saying, gee, I didn't have the right context beginning. And so I want to be clear. My questions tonight are heavily oriented toward, are these the right words? And yes, some frustration with the heavy-handed language that comes down to us from FEMA. However, the city chose to become a part of this and chose the 2-foot level for the individual ratepayer on their flood insurance as a better choice, so that in the city's determination as a better choice overall, and so that can be tough to the individual or in some cases to the developer who's going, oh geez, this is, you know, look what this is doing to me house to house to house. But the overall intent and what's behind it, I think, was a good effort by the city, and certainly that's, you know, the things that I'm poking at are really oriented toward how much of this has to be dictated, how much of it is some flexibility. We're learning most of it's not flexible.
Yeah. So let me explain a little bit more. So these are federal. The National Flood Insurance Program has federal regulations. And the city did choose to join the National Flood Insurance Program, just like every other city and county in this country that has houses in the floodplain. Because if you are not part of the National Flood Insurance Program, you cannot purchase flood insurance. If you can't purchase flood insurance, you can't buy a house with a mortgage. And so they get the communities that way. If you want anyone to be able to build in a floodplain like North Bend, if no one could build new houses in the floodplain because they couldn't get flood insurance, there would be a lot these federal regulations kind of just trickle down. We have baseline regulations. There's also state baseline regulations. The state requires 1 foot above base flood elevation, so the city has only increased it by 1 foot. But the difference is flood insurance is a lot less expensive when you go 2 feet than 1 feet. So initially, it's different when there's a developer building it, but if a homeowner is building their own home, they may pay a little bit more to go up to 2 feet, but their flood insurance rates are going to be so much lower that it will only take a few years before they come out ahead. And so.
But I would rather, as speaking on behalf of the people like me, live a lot of years, I still don't know all the regulations of life. And I'm just saying that I have a whole different, I said, where in this document does explain to me what this is all about? I'm expected to know, as an informed reader, I'm expected to know what this is all about. If there's something in here that talked about this, these few chapters deal with properties that are inside the floodway, and these regulations are being prompted by federal government and federal insurance. Help me understand why I'm going to start paying all these additional funds because of the expense of the insurance and the expense of paying off insurance if a situation happens.
More of that is
it pays off the risk. So I get that. But if I didn't, I'm walking this thing flat cold and I'm seeing all these picky fees. What the hell are we doing here?
So more of that's in our floodplain management plan, in our hazards chapter of our comprehensive plan, where it describes the purpose of participating in the National Flood Insurance Program and what we're trying to do with that, with our regulations, to reduce our ratepayers' discounts, or the fees for our ratepayers within the floodplain.
I'm
just going to say, just a question pops in my head. How much of the city, inside the city boundaries, is FEMA? Insurance participating? How much of the land base?
It's probably about a third.
That much.
All of our historic downtown.
It's at least a third.
Yes, all the working area on the maps is the 100-year floodplain where you're required to purchase insurance, flood insurance.
Okay.
Well, and so that was part of one of my points of context, because it seemed like it was just several weeks ago or a couple of months ago where we were filing a new report. It was with FEMA, I think, all based on the point system. Yeah. And, you know, the context of our conversation was around what can we do to get more points or fewer points, whatever the scale was, to try and influence those flood insurance rates lower.
Right.
So these are all, to me, related.
Right.
These kind of development regulations are all part of mitigating that risk, but that context isn't clear when you're just, I think part of, to your point, Dick, when we're just looking at essentially a standalone ordinance, because we don't want to just do part of the job on trying to influence those, and I know until that meeting, or until that kind of deliberative process, I didn't really understand the relationship between some of these preventive measures and the flood insurance, and it's not really clear. It's very difficult to try and do that cost versus benefit. Spend $500 here, save $5,000 there.
Mm-hmm.
That gets lost when you're just looking at fees or development regulations. You kind of lose the connection to the rates themselves and even the ability to get insurance to be able to do the kind of things that we're now talking about how to regulate.
Some of that discussion happens on an individual basis with people who apply for flood permits. We get the flood permit, the building permit application, look at the building permit application to make sure that all of these requirements are shown on the building plans, and if they're not, have a discussion with that applicant and tell them why these are being required. And so there's some education that goes along just with the building permit process.
Right. No, I get that. You probably feel like you have the same conversation like 500 times a year. I'm thinking more at the policymaker level. At the policymaker level, so that you kind of see the connection and the benefit versus impact.
No, it's a really good point for bringing this like to council. I think that's a good point to say. This is why we're doing this, and this is what we will receive and benefit from doing this from FEMA.
For that council member who may listen to this audio, then that's exactly what I was thinking was, guys, that needs to be the preamble
right.
when you present this at council. Mr. Chair, I'm with text. I've got a couple comments on our draft report.
Got about 15 minutes to wrap this at 9.
Easy for me.
Okay. I have one question. I was trying to connect to the introduction on staff report that talked about the different door options. And the North Bend's currently door 3, which has the habitat assessment. Door 2 sounded like we're able to achieve compliance just by showing the connection and the layering of these regulations and how we meet that. So does door 2 then preclude needing a habitat assessment? That's my first question. And where I didn't see in the ordinance itself any reference to the doors. I saw it in the introduction, so I'm wondering, is that like a case-by-case, project-by-project decision which door you want to go through?
Each community in Puget Sound will start out as a door 3 community just by default. You'll have to do a habitat assessment on a permit-by-permit basis. And then to move to door 1, door 1 is you just
we don't want to do door
adopt
one.
The model ordinance,
right,
and it's way more complicated
than
this one. And then door 2, like you said, is we show that all the regulations layered on top of each other achieve the same results as the model ordinance, basically. And it takes away the requirement to do the individual habitat assessment for each project.
Right.
But staff is still required to review the project to make sure that all of those code provisions are met, which is part of the review process anyway. But we have tried to go through the process with FEMA to be recognized as door 2 and ran into some roadblocks because they wanted certain provisions verbatim in the ordinance, which we are not including in the ordinance.
Okay. So the doors, that was really just procedural explanatory kind of language. It wasn't part of the decision making that we're kind of undertaking here.
Well, this may help get to a door 2 status.
But that's a separate process.
Separate process, yeah.
Okay. And then on the habitat assessment, maybe it was in here, I just missed it, because I think in your opening comment you talked about, really it's all about the endangered species, which we don't have necessarily here. So is the habitat assessment assessing impact to all habitat within the project area, or is it assessing habitat impacts relative to the endangered species?
So it's assessing direct and indirect impacts to those species. So if
the endangered species.
Yeah, the endangered species. And so if it was only direct impacts, this would be much easier for the city because that would be the dead fish on your shoreline. But that's not going to happen here. So we only have the indirect impacts of water quality and other types of issues that may go downstream and indirectly impact. So unfortunately,
I guess my question is, do we need a habitat assessment to determine the impacts, or is there that kind of information available just through the project information itself as opposed to doing a habitat study?
Well, the habitat assessment, the checklist that we put together is, as long as you can answer those questions with one of the answers we've provided, you're not going to have an impact.
That's not just an internal analysis, though. FEMA actually wants those habitat assessments, so they kind of have to see that name and certain things on that form.
So we put this together because it makes it easy just to check boxes. Yeah, and as some point there's going to be tracking. It's taking a long time to get to that point, but the city's going to have to tell FEMA, report to FEMA on these things, which I think they end up not doing because it's so complicated they can't implement it. But
FEMA, you're talking.
FEMA, yeah. But we can't do it. We just can't do it verbally or without documenting anything. So, no, did that answer your question a second time?
Yeah.
You just can't get around it.
I mean, it gets back to how many hoops do you have to jump through for some of these projects when the direct or indirect really are probably minimal to
they're super
to
minimal.
Yeah.
It's
and could be
addressed
through some of the other regulations
they're,
they have.
Yeah, that's why it's, they're all addressed through other regulations.
Got it.
Yeah, okay. It seems very duplicative and frustrating, but it's one of those things that we just need to jump through to participate in that.
Well, that's I guess it's good that it does seem like it is because it actually is.
It is. Yeah.
It seems like it is, but it really isn't. All right, thank you. Those were my questions.
Anything else? James, do you have anything?
On the maps, no disrespect to the consultant, but when these translate to code documents.
Oh, they'll be updated for that.
Yeah, we're going to incorporate into our GIS system. Yeah.
That's my comment.
Okay, yeah. The city has the data, the GIS data, so the city can put it on a big map like this so that when you zoom in on it, you can actually see things.
Oh, well, it's not just about that, but I'm just saying we shouldn't be.
Oh, yeah. My logo is not going to be on there.
Yeah.
So this is referenced in the regulation, but this is not the adopted map.
Gotcha, thank you. On the draft staff report, I get just a couple minor things. Page 2, under the impacts of the proposed amendment, number 2, economic impacts. The amendment may have negative minor economic impacts. I suggest we strike minor. To me, word like that is subjective and argumentative. You just simply say negative economic impacts. Is anyone disagreeing? Top of page 3, don't have a specific proposed change, but the second sentence under item number 4, the floodplain regulations already prevent against adverse downstream impacts. I'm struggling with the wording, and I don't know if it's just my head's not working when I get to prevent against. Is that?
Oh,
does that prevent adverse downstream impacts?
Yeah, it's like a double negative almost.
Already prevent adverse,
that means. Get rid of the word against.
Yeah.
So, strike against. Okay, thank you. And under 4, Planning Commission findings and analysis, number 3, second sentence in our response, the amendments provide guidance. The amendments provides, right?
Are you reading from this? What paragraph? 5?
In the findings on page 3.
Yep, findings.
Item number 3, the question is the proposed change the best means, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I'm saying second sentence should read, the amendments provide guidance. It was pluralized. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Okay. It's apparent that you read these.
Gary, did you have something else?
Nope, I got my questions on.
James? All right, well, that's what I have as well. We want to.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion. I move to approve amendments to the floodplain management regulations in North Bend Municipal Code 1412. as amended this evening.
I'll second.
Any further comments?
Just wanted a clarification. The only amendment in the actual regulations that I caught, other than typo type of things, was the reference to the
2500
to add the statement that the King County Channel Migration Study is what formally identified the location of the channel migration zone.
Dollar
one.
And we're going to modify
the value.
Yes,
the value on page 3, about 750 increasing to 2500. And then just some minor typos in addition to that.
A lot of discussion and clarification.
Not valuable discussion, you might say, right?
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Always good to be clear what we're talking about. So, all right. All those in favor of approving floodplain management regulations, North Bend Municipal Code 14.12, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. None opposed? All right, motion carries. It's unanimous.
Who would second?
I second.
Floodplain management moving forward. All right.
And Christina, I for one would like to thank you for not only being here tonight, your help on this, but as you've probably picked up on, I've been in contact with her in numerous times through this past year, and her expertise has been well shown and helpful, and dealing with FEMA is just about the most horrendous thing I've ever done, honestly, and government regulation, and so it's just not fun.
Thank you for that.
You do it for a living.
Well, once you understand it, once I started to understand it, then I started to like it for whatever reason.
Messiness.
Everyone has their own thing.
Yeah. All right, anything for the good of the order?
So your next meeting, we'll have an interesting workshop. David's going to be leading that on ways to address housing affordability. So different options available to the city. Housing affordability is really becoming a primary issue. So workforce housing, possible inclusionary housing requirements, a lot of different options out there. So he'll just be laying those options on the table and seeking some direction about where we want to go with that.
Yeah, and I've heard about the last council meeting, they were talking about workforce housing, I believe.
Mm-hmm. And as I had alerted you all to at our last meeting, this past week's business forum, that was the focus, was workforce and affordable housing, and it was a great session. And so it'll be a surprise to you that I'll have a lot to say.
I know we always have an agenda, but I would request that it, would say more than just inclusionary housing work session. Like if we could, just so I could have an idea what we're going to talk about specifically, because I really have no idea. Just some high-level topics or something like that.
And I would just add to that, if there were, when the packet comes out, since it always comes out a week or so in advance, if there are some resources for those of us that this topic will be brand new, particularly if David is going to be looking for some guidance, I'd like to learn more about what's the topic we're even going to be discussing.
I believe that's his intent, is to provide you guys with some reading materials ahead of time.
In advance. Okay, perfect.
That's great.
And I don't know if that's going to include, I sent out the deck that we used to the business forum, so Dave's got that as well. I don't know if we're planning to use that or not. And I don't know if you would rather present it that night, share it ahead of time, whatever.
And there's the North Bend Halloween party coming up, right? Head on down. Hopefully the weather's good. All right. I have a motion to adjourn the meeting.
So moved.
Second.
All right.
8:57. We are done.